up with some kind of plan. But I also knew no plan could work if my mother wasn't better. Chapter 10. The lights flickered off again the next afternoon. The overhead fan slowed to a halt. Another blackout. My forehead trickled with sweat. Seema was back from school and doing her best to corral Safa and Rabia, whose shouts echoed off the concrete floor, hammering into my brain. It turned out my father was right about yesterday. The cup of tea with Fozia and Mariam wasn't any sort of magic cure. As usual, my mother spent the morning with the curtains drawn. She barely spoke a word when I went inside to check on her. She wasn't on the mend. Maybe she never would be. I had to get out for a little while. I counted the money I needed for the market. Seema's back was turned to me.
"Get your hands out of the flour," she yelled at a powder-white Safa.
"I'll get her," I wanted to say, but the words never left my mouth. I was allowed a few moments of peace without any of my sisters yanking at my sleeve, wasn't I? Just this once? I slipped past Seema and out the house. It was only a trip to the market, but I would cherish this time to myself. The sounds of tractors, bicycle bells, and children playing cricket in the street filled me with a sense of calm. I knew each store owner and vendor I passed. I knew their wives and their children. But today, traveling the same streets I'd walked hundreds of times before, without little hands to keep out of fruit stands, without tiny feet to steer around idling rickshaws, I noticed it all as though for the first time. The sun was hotter than usual for the time of year, but I even enjoyed this. Shokut's store was bustling. My neighbors filled the aisles, sifting through the vegetables and fruit.
"Why is it so busy today?" I asked my neighbor Balkis.
"New arrivals, pomegranates, coconuts, apples," she replied.
She waved at the shoppers with one hand and fanned her face with a newspaper with the other. Needed some turmeric, but didn't know I'd have to fight these crowds. You'd think Shokut was giving things away for free. I squeezed through the aisle. Two pomegranates rested in the crate perched next to the onions and apples. Red, sweet, delicious pomegranates. I counted my money. I had enough to buy one extra item. Something small. Just for me. I snatched one up as a woman grabbed the other. One of my neighbors argued with Shokut over bruised zucchini and squash. I grabbed a handful of onions and some ginger and leaned past her to pay. Slinging my satchel over my shoulder, I stepped back onto the dusty road. I gripped the red fruit in my palm. Maybe this pomegranate was the sign of hope I needed. A bit of sweetness after all the bitterness. I would share it with Omer and Seema. It didn't make everything better, but the thought made me happy. Even now, I can remember how happy I felt in that moment. That moment, before my world changed. One second, I was standing. The next, slammed backward onto the ground. A car, black with darkened windows. How did I miss it? How wrapped up in my mind was I not to notice a car? The door opened, and footsteps approached. I took in the clean-shaven face, the closely trimmed hair, and the eyes hidden by dark sunglasses. People began to gather by the side of the road. Balkis, Hira, Shokut, customers from the market. Why didn't any of them help me? Why did they stare at this strange man and say nothing? I stumbled to my feet. My hands were scraped and bloody. My leg throbbed when I put my weight on it, but I could stand. I gritted my teeth and gathered the bruised ginger and onions lying scattered along the road and tossed them in my satchel.
"You should pay better attention," the stranger said.
I saw his hand reach down and pick up my pomegranate. He stepped closer to me.
"Are you hurt?"
he asked.
Where do you live?
I'll take you home.
He was smiling. His teeth were so white, the whitest I had ever seen.
I'm fine, I told him. I reached up to adjust my chador, cloaking myself from him. I was about to walk away when I realized he was still holding my pomegranate. He followed my gaze.
My mother loves these, he said. You won't mind if I take this for her, will you? Of course, I'll pay you for it, and you can buy more.
It was the last one.
Will this do?
He pulled out a handful of money. What was he doing? Did he think I was a beggar? That everything was for sale?
My mother's voice told me to let this go. Something was off with this man. Let him have the fruit and walk away. But all I could see was the red pomegranate, and how he grasped it in his palm, as though it was already his. I thought of my father, who had no time for my dreams, my little sisters, and their endless demands. Suddenly I felt tired. Tired of feeling powerless. Tired of denying my own needs because someone else needed something more. Including this man. This stranger, buying me off. Denying me this smallest of pleasures.
It's not for sale.
So you'll give it without charge? His smirk taunted me. My scraped hands burned.
You hit me with your car and want to take my things?
My voice trembled. I heard it growing louder, as if it were coming from someone else.
I'm not giving it away.
I snatched it from his hand. The crowd murmured. I started walking away.
Stop!
His voice was so loud it echoed off the buildings. I didn't stop. I walked quickly until I turned the corner toward home. Only then did I break into a run. The farther I ran, the sicker I felt. Who was that man? What exactly had I done? Chapter 11. The knock on the door the next morning sent my heart racing. I opened it slowly, half expecting to see the man with the dark sunglasses. But it was Fosia. She came empty-handed today. I waited for her to ask me about yesterday. If there was gossip, Fosia would have been one of the first to hear it. But she barely glanced at me before going to see my mother. I lingered by my parents' door while my mother and Fosia talked about the baby. As they discussed what to do about Lubna's sniffling, I stood there and waited for the words to leave Fosia's mouth. To tell my mother what happened. Finally, Fosia said,
I'll pick up the baby's medicine for you. I was on my way to the market anyway. Glad you're doing better.
She stood up. She walked past me, and I watched her leave. Why didn't she say anything? Maybe I made a bigger deal out of what happened. Either way, I learned my lesson. I would follow the rules from now on. I would never step so much as a toe out of this house without one of my sisters with me.
Read to us?
Rabia asked me that afternoon. She brought a book and pulled on my arm. I had spent the day working as hard as I could. I mopped the floors and scrubbed the walls. I folded and put away all the laundry and chopped up the onions for dinner. I sat down on the sofa with her and Safa. I smiled at the story she chose. My father had bought it years ago for me when he went to Lahore. You know, this was my book once, I asked.
We know, Rabia said. That's why we love it.
I read them the story about a kitten who decided to adopt a basket of mice. I laughed along with my sisters when the kitten scolded the mice before they scattered, running in every direction. I was so engrossed, I didn't hear the door swing open and Seema charge in until she grabbed me by the arm and ushered me into the kitchen.
They're talking about it, she said before I could say a word.
Who is?
Everyone. They're talking about yesterday.
Before I could ask her more, the door opened again. My father.
Tell me it's not true.
Sweat trickled down his forehead. If you tell me it's a lie, I will believe you.
I'm sorry, I whispered.
Amal, his hands fell to his sides. Talking back to Jawad Saab? Of all people, what have you done?
Jawad Saab? My mouth went dry like the dusty earth. Fozia called him worse than his notorious father. And I yelled at him, in front of everyone.
He wants a word with me, this Friday. One of his officers dropped off this note.
He held up a crumpled piece of paper.
Didn't know what was going on until the workers told me.
Abu, I stammered. I should have told you right away, but his car, it hit me. I was minding my own business walking home from the market, but he wouldn't let me be. He wanted to give me a ride home. He took my things and wouldn't give them back.
I don't care if he wanted your entire satchel of things, my father snapped. You give it to him. You drop everything at his feet, apologize, and walk away. Don't you have any idea the lengths that family goes to just to satisfy their egos? And Jawad Saab especially. Don't you know what he could do to us now?
Malik, enough. You're scaring the little ones. It took me a second to recognize my mother out of bed. She stood at the archway of her bedroom door, the baby in her arms.
Do you have any idea what your daughter's been up to? He shouted.
I didn't know who he was, I whimpered.
Did it matter? Have we not taught you how to act in public? Bite your tongue 1 minute and prevent a lifetime of burden.
And yelling won't solve this, my mother said. Let's talk again once we've calmed down.
It's not fair.
Tears slipped down my cheeks.
His car hit me. He took my things. Why am I the one in trouble? Since when has life been fair?
He shook his head.
You can read books and tell me the capital of China, but you have no idea how the world works. God only knows how he will find it fit to punish us.
He wouldn't do anything serious over something so small, would he? I asked.
He's done far more for far less.
All this over a simple pomegranate, still lying uneaten in my satchel, buried beneath my bed. I thought of the person from the car, the gleaming white teeth, the close-cropped hair, and the way his voice went from sweet like honey to cold and dark within seconds. I thought of the stories I'd heard all my life, the way Shokat's jaw clenched at the mention of his name, the way Fozia said he loved to dole out punishments and had personally burned an entire village to the ground. So what kind of punishment would he dream up for me? Chapter 12. I got out of bed as the sun peeked its head over the horizon. I hadn't slept in 2 days. Jawad Saab would be here tomorrow. Stepping into the kitchen, I blinked. My mother was out of bed again. She perched on a stool on the ground, kneading dough for buttery breakfast parathas like she used to. Her waist-length hair fell unbraided in waves around her shoulders.
You're up early, she said.
Her eyes were red, her cheeks blotchy.
I'm sorry, I said. Guilt pooled inside me, liquid and dense.
She wiped her floured hands with a rag and stood up.
I'm the one who should apologize, she told me. I haven't been a good mother lately.
No, Amma, please don't say that.
You're my eldest, but you're still a child, she said to me. I don't know. It's like I'd fallen into some kind of well the last month. Everything was so dark. It happens for a while each time I have a child.
Because we're girls, I whispered.
What?
That's not true.
She gripped my hand in hers.
I was there. You were crying. You wanted a son.
Yes. We did want a son, she sighed. But it doesn't mean we don't love our daughters. You're part of me. How can I not love you?
Why is having a boy all anyone can talk about?
Who else will care for us in our old age? Who will run the farm and keep your grandfather's dream alive?
I could, I told her. Seema and I both would.
You will get married one day. Then you'll belong to a new family.
But I'm part of this family.
I wish it wasn't this way, but this is how the world works. It doesn't mean I don't love my daughters. I love each and every one of you.
What are we going to do, Amma? I whispered. I made such a huge mistake.
Don't you worry. We'll fix it. We will. I used to sit with my mother most mornings as she made breakfast in the early hours while everyone slept. It was the only chance I ever had to be alone with her. I would tell her what I learned in school, the latest drama I might have had with my friends. If anyone could come up with a way to fix this, she could. She always knew how to make things right. When Omar and Seema returned from school, we gathered by the wire chicken coop in the backyard, obscured from view. I've been running it over and over in my head, I told them. I still can't figure out what he's going to do tomorrow.
He's not going to do anything, Seema said. If he wanted to do something, he'd have done it by now.
Everyone knows. He doesn't think. He acts.
The things he's done, though. Rumors, she said. They're just rumors.
I looked at Omar, but he twisted the heel of his sandal in the dirt. He didn't meet my eyes. I didn't want to tell Seema about Manira's blackened fields. I couldn't bring myself to correct her. Afraid if I said it out loud, it might come true.
Don't worry, she put her arm around me. By this time tomorrow, this will all be behind us.
Chapter 13. The hard-knuckled knock on our front door sent a chill through our household early the next morning. Seema and I sat up in bed. Safa and Rabia had slept with us last night. Safa began to speak, but, upon seeing our faces, stayed silent. The front door creaked open. Footsteps echoed through the house. I pressed my ear against the bedroom door.
"Welcome to our home. It's an honor," my father said. "I'll call my wife to prepare tea."
"I'm not here for tea. I'm here about your daughter."
That voice, the same cold voice from the day at the market. His voice was ice water poured down my spine.
"Saab, we are beside ourselves over what happened. Please, forgive her foolish mistake."
"Forgive? How can I forgive when the harm is done? I take some of the blame for this disrespect. I haven't been as involved with matters around here as I used to be. People forget what they don't see."
"We haven't forgotten. We are forever in your debt."
"Yes," he replied. "You are. And given the circumstances, I'm left with no choice but to collect."
Collect? What was he talking about?
"Please, Saab, I have no means to pay you back yet. You know how little we have."
"No, this couldn't be right. It was the one thing our mother always said. Never take on more than you could bear. And never be indebted to anyone, especially someone like this."
"If I had the money, I would lay it at your feet, but I don't have it."
"Then she will do."
There was a long silence.
"I don't understand," my father finally said.
She will live on my estate and work for me. She will pay off your debts.
She's practically a child, my father stammered.
I would like to let it go, but if I let this pass, who will disrespect me next?
Sending my daughter away like this. I can't, Saab.
She will be treated like all my servants. No better, no worse. I'll even let her visit twice a year, like the others.
I backed away from the door. I heard wrong. I must have. But why then did Seema stare at me like she saw a djinn? She motioned me back to the door.
I'll give you a few days to discuss. But I promise, you will like the alternatives far less.
The door opened and shut. A car engine sprang to life. Tires rumbled against dirt and gravel. The room was shrinking, closing in on me. Flinging open the kitchen door, I rushed into the backyard, past the workers in the sugarcane fields, past the tractors, their noise blurring into the distance.
Amal, wait!
Seema raced after me. But I didn't stop. I kept running as if the farther I went, the farther I could leave my destiny behind. Chapter 14.
Over my dead body.
My mother's voice was low, almost a growl. My sisters and I lingered by the closed entrance of my parents' bedroom. It had now been 2 days since Jawad Saab visited our home, and my parents began arguing without end.
You discuss this as though there's a choice, my father said. Is our daughter not dear to me also?
Be reasonable.
So we give up our respect? She goes off to become a servant, and what becomes of her? And what about the rest of our girls? They are young, but think of their futures. Who will marry a girl whose family has been shamed like this?
I spoke with the village elders. Our neighbors feel sympathy, not judgment toward us. This won't change anything for the other girls. Besides, it could have been worse. It's not as if she'll be out in the fields. She'll be a servant in that house. And Jawad Saab gave me his word. He won't harm Amal.
His word? His word can change with the tides. What need does he have to keep his promises? You're the one who took loans from a viper without breathing a word to me. You fix it. Do you hear yourself? When the rains came 5 years ago and destroyed all the wheat before we could harvest it, or when the drought shriveled the sugarcane to dust last year, how do you think we survived? A miracle? I did what I had to do to protect this family. I would rather have died than owe him a thing. And thanks to you, we owe him our daughter. Who doesn't owe him money? Make the monthly payments and there's no problem. None of this would have happened if you hadn't decided to stop functioning. Children were running this home. What else could we expect?
There was a long silence. Then my mother wept. I walked away from the door and into my bedroom. I wished Seema was home from school. My stomach hurt more and more these days. My guilt was hollowing me from the inside out. The door creaked open. In a place so filled with people, spaces seldom stayed empty for long. But it wasn't one of my little sisters who walked inside. It was my father. He sat next to me on my bed, his eyes fixed on his sandals. He had avoided me since we last talked, but sitting next to me now, his eyes damp, his shoulders hunched. He didn't look angry. He looked like my father.
I shouldn't have taken money from him, he said. I was desperate. He preys on people in their moments of weakness.
I thought I'd pay it back with the next harvest, but the debt kept growing. I owed money on what I owed. He told me I could take my time. I thought he was generous. Now I know the truth. How else to keep us forever under their thumb? His eyes locked into mine. Do you know how hard your grandfather worked to buy this little patch of land? I know, I whispered. When I was your age, we went hungry for months, saving everything we could. My father wanted us to be our own masters, to have something to pass down to future generations. I'm the only son in my family. It's up to me to keep this land ours and honor your grandfather's memory. Does everything our family worked for come to an end now? This isn't what any of us want.
Abu, I can't leave. What if I never come back?
I pushed down a sob.
Never come back?
He placed his arm around me.
You think I'd let you go away forever?
He wants his money.
I'll get him his money. I swear on my life, I will get you home as soon as I possibly can. I'll make things right.
How long?
I wiped a tear.
How long will I live there?
A few weeks. A month at the most. You won't be there long. I looked at the pile of books in the corner of my room. A month ago, I washed the chalkboard with Miss Sadia. I sat with Omar on the fallen tree. I was going to be a teacher. How could everything as solid as the earth my grandfather fought for crumble so easily beneath my feet?
Chapter 15. Jawad Saab's driver would be here any minute. My suitcase was packed and resting by my bed. My mother had lent me the aluminum-cased one from her own wedding dowry. She filled it to the brim with clothing, nuts, and dried fruits. There was a tap on my bedroom door, and then Hafsa entered. She closed the door and approached me.
"I was thinking about it last night," she whispered.
"What if you ran away? Maybe hid in my house?" "Hafsa, I couldn't do that."
"My parents wouldn't even need to know," she said. "My closet is pretty big. Nobody would ever guess you were at my place, and it could give us some time to figure out what to do next."
"I can't. It wouldn't be safe. Not for me, and definitely not for you," I told her.
"But that's what friends do."
Hafsa's eyes watered.
"You would do the same for me."
"I know." I gave her a hug. "It means a lot, but if I don't go, he'll go after my family." "And besides," I thought, "how long could we keep it up anyway? It's not as if I could simply run away without looking back. This was all I knew. My roots sank too deep into this earth." When we stepped out of the bedroom, Fozia was sitting with my mother on our sofa. They wore cotton shalwar kameezes, white, the kind some wore when attending a burial.
"I knew he was wicked," Fozia's eyes welled. "But who knew he was the devil himself?"
"Did you pack everything you need?" Seema asked me.
"I think so. Don't know how I managed to squeeze it all in."
"Room for one more?"
She handed me the doll from my childhood, the one our mother made for each of us.
"You found it?"
I scooped up the soft, worn doll and pressed its fabric against my nose.
"I decided to think like Safa. I found it wedged between the bundles of old clothes in the closet."
"Thanks, Seema." I hugged her, our damp cheeks pressed together. I didn't know how I could handle this if Seema wasn't here. She would help Rabia and Safa through this. She would watch over our family.
"Everyone keeps crying,"
Rabia tugged at my leg. My sisters hadn't left my side all morning. The little ones clutched my camise.
It's time, isn't it?
Parveen said, as she and Omer joined us. Parveen's expression was drawn. I wanted to tell her how much I'd miss her, but the words lodged in my throat. Instead, I hugged her. I longed to hug Omer, too, but in such a crowded room, I didn't dare.
I should have come up with a solution, he told me. I was up all night. Nothing. I couldn't think of anything.
Abu promised he'll get the money, I said. I shouldn't be gone long, a month at the most. I tried not to focus on the fact that he wasn't here. He had stood over my bed early this morning watching me while he thought I was asleep. He had kissed my forehead. I realized now he was saying goodbye. A car pulled up outside, the engine cut off. I glanced around my home, taking in one last long look at the worn sofa and handmade rug. My family and friends. Rabia and Safa were still attached to me. I lifted them up one at a time and pressed my face to their soft cheeks. I kissed them twice, then three times. But would I ever get enough? There was a knock on the door. My mother pressed a clump of money into the palm of my hand, along with a gray phone.
It's Fosia's old phone. Call as soon as you can. Let me know you're safe.
She wiped my eyes.
You will be strong. You will hold your head up high. No matter what happens, no matter where you are, you're my daughter.
I kissed Lubna. I hugged my mother one last time. I had hardly ever stepped outside my home without someone by my side. Now I was leaving alone. A gray-haired man in an ill-fitting suit was at the door. He picked up my suitcase, and before I lost my nerve, before I ran away and never stopped, I followed him toward the waiting black vehicle. I opened the door and sat inside. So many firsts. My first time in a car. My first time feeling cool air pressing against my face. My first time saying goodbye to everything I had ever known.
Chapter 16. The familiar stretches of brown and green patchwork earth I had known all my life swept past me in a blur before transforming into plush, manicured green as the car slowed down and the driver turned onto a gravel road lined with shade trees. When the estate materialized in the distance, only the second-story windows and balconies were visible from behind the huge brick wall surrounding it. An armed guard with a grim expression led us in at the wrought-iron gate. The steel lock clicked loudly when the gate shut behind us. The driver walked me into the cavernous house and dumped my things next to a marble staircase in the middle of the foyer before turning to leave.
"Wait, Ghulam, what's this?"
asked a gangly teenager with a mop of curls. He stared at me from across the foyer.
"How should I know?" the man grumbled. "I'm Nasreen's driver, not his. Why I'm stuck running his errands is beyond me."
He walked away, his footsteps echoing into the distance. The teenager stood in a sunken living room with oversized sofas. Next to him stood a younger girl, about my age, with a sharp jaw and straight brown hair. Floor-to-ceiling windows behind them overlooked a tiled veranda with wicker sofas and a sprawling garden.
"I think that's the new girl Mumtaz told us about," the girl said. "Remember?"
"What do we need a new servant for?"
"How should I know, Bilal?"
She turned to me and asked, "Do you know where you're supposed to go?" I shook my head.
"Where's Mumtaz?"
the girl asked Bilal.
"She'll know."
"Probably in the servants' quarters."
"Can you take her?"
"Nabila, you know I have to get these shoes to Jawad Saab. I'm already running late."
"Well,
If she stands there gawking, it'll be us he yells at for not putting her to work.
She sighed and walked over to me.
Come on, she told me. Let's find Mumtaz. She'll know what to do.
Well, good luck.
Bilal nodded to us before he hurried away. I lugged my suitcase and tried to keep up with her, but it was hard not to get distracted. This house was unlike anything I'd ever seen. Back home, I could touch my ceiling with my hand if I stood on a chair. But here, the ceiling seemed to graze the sky. Grim-faced family members stared at me from photographs lining the egg-white hallways. Each room we passed was larger than the one before it, and all were filled with brilliant rugs covering marble floors. Light poured in through enormous windows. I followed Nabila through a curved entrance down a new hallway. Everything was darker and shabbier here. Instead of marble floors, this part of the house had gray concrete. The cooled air of the main home was replaced here by hot, musty air and the smell of frying onions. A man in a faded shalwar kameez holding a broom and a dustpan brushed past me as he headed toward the main house. A woman followed behind, carrying a basket of laundry, pants and shirts and shalwar kameezes piled in a heap.
Your arm any better?
The woman paused to ask Nabila.
Oh.
Nabila glanced down. Only now did I realize her left arm had white gauze wrapped around it.
The burn looked worse than it was. The tray was too bulky, and there were too many things on it.
Well, keep it bandaged for a week, she said. Make sure it doesn't get worse.
I will, Nabila said to the woman. Did you find out how long Jawad Saab's going out of town for?
I know he's leaving after dinner. Bilal just loaded a pretty big suitcase into his trunk. It's got to be at least a week or two, but hopefully longer.
She smiled before continuing on. Nabila ushered me farther down the narrow hallway and stopped at a rickety door. It creaked when she pushed it open.
This is the only spare room, so it must be yours, she told me. You're next to Shagufta, the woman I was just talking to.
I took in the cramped, windowless space, empty except for the worn charpai. This wasn't a bedroom. It was a prison cell. Beads of sweat prickled my forehead.
What's going on? A voice said.
It was an older woman with a nose ring, like my mother's.
This is Mumtaz, Nabila told me before turning to her. I was looking for you. The new girl arrived. She gestured toward me. I didn't know where to put her.
She's going to be in the room next to Nazreen's.
Nazreen Baji's room?
Nabila stared at her.
I know. She just told me, Mumtaz replied.
But why? Nabila asked.
How should I know?
Mumtaz glanced at my suitcase.
Bring that along with you into the kitchen for now. Nazreen wants you to get acquainted there. She'll meet with you after dinner.
I lifted my suitcase and pushed back my growing dread.
It's hard at first, I know, Mumtaz said gently.
But you get used to it.
Get used to it? I thought of Safa and Rabia shrieking through the house, Lubna sleeping in my arms, the sound of Omer's bicycle chime. That was the life I was used to, and it felt as distant to this one as the stars in the night sky. The stars that could no longer guide me home.
Chapter 17. I trailed Mumtaz into a kitchen that featured a metal sink the size of a table. Fluorescent lights hung over counters that ran the length of the room. The windows against the far wall were cranked open, but the slight breeze did nothing to cool the hot, stuffy room. Just outside the window was a simpler veranda for the servants, with some threadbare charpais and stools stacked against a wall. A girl who couldn't have been more than 9 years old chopped onions but paused to smile at me. Next to her, a man with a gray mustache stirred three different pots.
The dishes, Mumtaz said, and pointed to a towering stack in the sink. Start on those.
I rested my suitcase by the door and walked to the sink. Pressing down the faucet, cool water rushed against my hands, a welcome reprieve from the stifling heat.
Officer's gone?
The cook asked.
Left a little while ago, Mumtaz said.
I hate serving him food after they leave, he grumbled. He finds something wrong with everything after they come.
I know. They have really been putting him on edge lately, Mumtaz said.
His father shouldn't have given him so much responsibility if he's going to be so thin-skinned.
If you think you have it bad, Hamid, think of Bilal, Mumtaz said. Poor guy is with Jawad most of the day and has the bruises on his arms to prove it. Be glad you're mostly out of sight back here in the kitchen.
Never thought I'd say it, but I miss his father, the cook said.
Mumtaz plucked cream-colored ceramic bowls and plates with gold trim out of the cupboards, while the little girl ladled chole, beef korma, and saffron-scented rice into serving platters. Can I help? I asked when I had finished the dishes. Mumtaz nodded to a pile of kebabs resting on a plate by the stove.
Get the kebabs from Hamid and put them out on one of the flat trays.
I arranged the kebabs on a platter and sprinkled them with chopped cilantro like I did at home. Mumtaz picked up a serving bowl and gestured for me to pick up the platter.
Come along, she said.
After the gossip and banging of pots in the kitchen, the main house was eerily silent.
At last, she arrives,
Jawad said when I entered the formal dining room and placed my platter on the sideboard next to Mumtaz's tray. He had no sunglasses on now, and his eyes bored into mine. I quickly looked away. His servant, Bilal, stood against the wall. He watched me curiously.
Enjoying it here so far?
Jawad Saab continued. I couldn't move, rooted by his gaze. Breathe, I reminded myself. I would not let him see me cower.
Not scaring the girl on her first day, are you?
Said a woman as she entered the room. She wore a silk shalwar kameez, her graying hair swept up into a bun. Jawad Saab leaned up and kissed her on the cheek.
You should thank her, he nodded to the woman. My mother was in the car that day you ran into us. She's the only reason you are here at all. I had other ideas on how to handle your disrespect.
His phone vibrated against the table, and his attention shifted.
Go!
He waved his hand at me and picked up the phone. I hurried toward the kitchen. My mother always said the best way to feel better was to do something, anything. And she was right. Making myself useful had always helped. Nabila was lifting an iron pot from the stove and maneuvering it toward the sink. I moved to help her, but before I could offer, the pot slipped from her hands and crashed to the concrete floor. The noise pierced my ears. Bits of leftover food splattered onto the ground and the adjacent wall. I grabbed a rag from the counter and leaned down to wipe up the mess.
Stop! Nabila said.
It looks worse than it is, I told her. We can clean it up in a minute.
I took care of myself before you came, and I'll take care of myself when you're washed out and long gone.
Nabila, Mumtaz chided.
The rag hung limp in my hand as I stared at Nabila. She lifted the pot and rested it in the sink. How did I make an enemy within an hour of arriving? The kitchen began to fill up as other servants filed in for their lunch. I recognized some of them, like Shagufta, who had been holding the laundry when I entered the servants' quarters earlier, and Ghulam, the driver who brought me here. I picked up a porcelain plate, but then I noticed the others grabbing metal ones from a separate cabinet. Their drinkware, too, came from the separate cupboard. I put the porcelain plate back down. I couldn't explain why it bothered me so much.
It wasn't as if I ever ate out of anything much fancier than what was set aside for us here. But Parveen and Omer ate out of the same plates and drank from the same cups as we did. There was a clear dividing line here, and I had to understand where I stood. We could prepare the platters and wash the porcelain plates and glasses, but we could not eat from them. The young girl came over and held out an empty plate for me.
"I'm Fatima. What's your name?"
she asked.
"My name is Amal."
I took the plate from her.
"Do you live here now?"
she asked. "I guess. I mean, for a little while I do."
"My father made this food. He's a really good cook. Hansa pays him extra, so he won't go anywhere else. The korma is one of his specialties."
"I love korma," I said. I ladled some onto my plate. The roti was cold, but I didn't mind, as I was nearly dizzy from hunger.
"His nihari is even better. He makes it for breakfast sometimes. I can get you some lemons for it when he makes it next. I know where he keeps them."
"Fatima, come eat before everything gets even colder," her father called to her.
I followed Fatima to the entrance of a room attached to the kitchen. The servants sat cross-legged in a circle on the floor. Fatima sat down next to her father. The plates rested on their laps.
"Is it true?"
asked the servant who had been carrying a broom earlier in the day.
"She hardly seems the type to do such a thing."
"She's here, isn't she?" Ghulam said between mouthfuls. "Kids these days like to mouth off. Don't care much for respect."
"He let her off easy," Nabila said, looking at me. "If the rumors are true, he could have done worse." I walked back into the kitchen and rested my plate on the counter. I understood people talked about other people. I was guilty of it myself. But how could they say such things when I was right there? That's when I saw Jawed Saab. He watched me from the kitchen entrance.
"I had one question for you."
Jawed Saab smiled.
"Was it worth it? The pomegranate you couldn't bear to part with?"
I'd promised myself I wouldn't cry in front of him, but my body betrayed me. Hot, salty tears slipped down my face. I looked down and stood still. I did my best not to move. I stood still until he was satisfied, until he walked away. Chapter 18. After dinner, Mumtaz led me up the marble staircase onto a carpeted landing. The second floor was as big as the first floor. Nasreen Baji's room was the first one on the right, just off the landing. Stepping inside, I saw a white bedroom set with cream sheets. A matching white armoire and dresser were in the distance. A makeup table rested next to a closed bathroom door. Light glowed from beneath its slats. I followed Mumtaz into an attached room that turned out to be an enormous closet, filled with Nasreen Baji's clothes and shoes. Through the closet we entered another room, rectangular and compact. The walls were a pale blue, with a border of elephants and giraffes.
"This is where you'll be staying," Mumtaz said.
"Here?"
I looked around at the nursery.
"This is my room?"
"There are many who would do a lot for a room in this part of the house. Now, put away your things, and then meet Nasreen," she said before leaving.
I thought of the stuffy, windowless concrete room from earlier today. Mumtaz was right. This room had air conditioning, and a blue-tiled bathroom with a porcelain sink and chrome handles like I'd seen on television. I unpacked my suitcase and glanced at the door, wondering what lay in store for me on the other side. The light still glowed from beneath the closed bathroom door when I stepped back into her room. I glanced at my satchel. I'd forgotten to put it away, but I did need to call my mother just to let her know I was safe. I took out my phone, but a knock on the bedroom door made me jump. Jawed Saab
stepped inside.
"Bored already?"
he said, looking at my phone. Is this how it would be here? This man lurking around every bend and curve?
I wanted to let my mother know I'm all right.
Your obligations are to me now.
He grabbed the phone from me.
The more you learn how to leave your backward ways behind, the easier things will be for you. Your days of being an idle farm girl are over.
Idle farm girl? Backward ways? I stared at my phone in his hands. My mother would tell me to be quiet right now and ignore these words. But how could he tear me from my home, take away the only connection I had to it, and then pronounce me backward? The words couldn't be stopped. I've never been idle. I went to school. I cared for my sisters. I helped my family. My voice broke. The ones you took me away from. He looked at me as though watching a field mouse develop the skill of speech. His eyes narrowed. The bathroom door opened.
Jawad, what's going on? I'm telling her how things will be.
That's my job, isn't it? She walked up to him.
If you take that away, what is there for me to do?
You're right. He kissed her cheek. His anger from moments earlier vanished. They chatted a bit longer. He told her he was heading out now. Bilal was staying back this time. He asked her to keep an eye on him. He told her he would stop by her favorite sweet shop on his way home. He promised to call. And then he tucked my phone into his pocket and walked away, taking the one lifeline I had to my family with him. Nasreen Baji walked to her makeup table and sat down on the cushioned bench. I watched her, uncertain what to do. Did I ask her how I could help, or wait for her to tell me what she needed? Was I supposed to stand with my hands to the side, or folded in front? The list of things I didn't know was endless. I stood frozen by the door. Nasreen Baji tapped her fingers against the table and then glanced into the mirror.
I could use some help, she told me, and when I walked up to her, she nodded at the brush on the table.
I picked up the wooden brush and parted Nasreen Baji's hair. I'd done this for my mother and sisters countless times, but never performed such an intimate task on a stranger. Nasreen Baji's hair was straight and brown, with threads of gray. My mother's hair was black like the night sky, falling over her shoulders in waves. Last time I brushed my mother's hair, taking care to gently tease out the knots with my fingers, she hummed lullabies to Safa, who lay curled in her lap. Thinking of my mother kept my hands steady.
Did Mumtaz tell you what you are expected to do in this household? She asked.
No, I told her.
You are here for me and anything I may need. You bring my meals and wait on me. When there's company, you wait on all of us. You massage my head if it hurts, and bring me my migraine medication. You will sleep with your door open, so if I need you, you can hear me. Understood?
I nodded. Before she could say more, the phone resting on the makeup table vibrated.
My husband.
She picked up the phone.
Khan Saab.
I was so afraid of Jawad Saab, I'd forgotten about his father, the monster in my childhood dreams, the boogeyman our mothers used to threaten us with when we were slow to finish our meals. He slept in this very room.
Thought you forgot to phone me, she said when she answered. Ghazala called this morning. She switched her dinner party to next month for us. I told her we'll be there.
She listened and smiled.
Yes. Glad something can wrench you from politics.
They spoke a little longer before she hung up.
He's away more than he's here. Off with my eldest boys in Islamabad.
Chasing politics at his age. Can you imagine? I tried to mask my relief. At least there was that. The man who haunted my childhood dreams was hardly ever here.
You must be missing your family, she said. This can't be easy. Unlike her sons, her words contained no malice. I nodded. I can relate. Of course, I married into the family, but no matter the circumstances, missing your family feels the same. You're from Nabechuk, aren't you?
Yes.
I'm from Banwechuk. Banwe? But that's a 10-minute walk from my house. It's on the other side of the market.
True, she said. You know the Morale?